In the wake of the Mainark dynasty's proclamation came a fear, as infectious and fast-moving as the technological plague the Necrons had already unleashed. The shroud that had fallen upon Imperial communication was wrenched back, revealing the horror that had already been committed. The thousand basilicas of Libethra, the fortress of the Angel's Revenant, had been reduced to a field of lava. The very crust of the world split and weeping under whatever planet-killing weapons had been targeted upon it. Apollyon, that bastion of the Inquisition, had likewise been shattered. The Necrons had caused its moon, Elohim Mortua, to crash into the world, ejecting whole continents into the void. The news spread like wildfire, the very communication nets it was carried upon continuing to swirl with the sinister glyphs of these mysterious invaders. Amraphel and Midwinter saw the outbreak of massive riots, lurching them towards the brink of total civic collapse as Imperial authorities attempted to suppress them. The hope of inbound reinforcements from the Eurydice sector did naught to stem the tide of terror. The first wave of the invasion had already riven the sector, with hundreds of millions of human lives being snuffed out in total blackness. What hope could yet there be? On the morning of 4-917-991-M41, the sun failed to rise on Drusilla Majoris, capital world of the Drusilla subsector. The 6 billion humans of the Hive world, gripped now within a night that may never end, could only watch as a dreadful cold descended upon their planet. All Vox traffic with ships in the nearby volume was abruptly cut off, and, out in the ash wastes of the Hive hinterlands, eldritch monuments of black, impenetrable stone began to rise from the polluted sands, edifices revealing themselves to the terrified onlookers. Elsewhere, guarding the orbital shipyards of Midwinter, the Romilis-class star fortress Taris received panicked distress calls, claiming to be under attack from unknown vessels and boarding parties of figures, quote, fashioned as specters of death. Despite even the major worlds of his sector appearing to be toppling like timber, Governor La'an refused any order of aggressive action, retreating to a fortified bunker beneath the gubernatorial palace on Amara, while the tens of millions of mustered soldiers and hundreds of warships remained on station high above. One by one, the systems surrounding the capital shrieked for aid before falling silent, their deaths marked by blazing, corpuscent pulses of celestial fire, a stamp placed upon the realms once held by humanity, but now deathly silent. Amara alone stood to beg the Imperium for aid. In every other respect, the Orpheus sector had been cut in half. The fall of over 50% of the Orpheus sector to the Mainark dynasty has entered into the annals of Imperial history as the Bloody Hundred, so-called because it took less than 100 Terran days standard. To accomplish the seizure of such a volume in such a time as less than 3 months was not without precedent per se, but the chaos and panic in its wake are entirely understandable. Billions of lives had been lost, and the enemy had barely been sighted, and decidedly not yet confirmed. This was no Orc War, the presence of which could scarcely have been any more explicit, or an arch-enemy campaign, replete with grand displays of debased religiosity. The Mainark invasion was implacable, silent, and supremely deadly, turning Imperial retreats into panicked, formless routs, snuffing out worlds with nary warning nor word. Victory after victory they claimed, seizing a staggering volume of space during the Bloody Hundred before, once again, halting in place. on 3-964-992-M41, Governor La'an ordered the general retreat of every single surviving imperial military element to Amara, hoping to use the reprieve to gather whatever scattered forces he could. As the days wore on, La'an's paranoia and mental instability, both of which had been growing since the beginning of the Bloody Hundred, appeared to become significantly worse, interfering with the strategic planning of Amara's defense. Relief began to appear in the form of out-of-sector reinforcements, trickling in from the system's Mandeville Point. Yet more sector local units from the Arcantis Cluster, far behind the line drawn between the Mainarch Crown Worlds and Amara that marked the invaders' advance thus far, likewise redirected to Amara, depriving them wholesale of any military protection. This significantly damaged Imperial morale and planetary political stability within the Arcantis Cluster, with terrified populaces and ruling classes both now well aware of the advancing doom that was taking place across the sector, leading to outright mutiny on several occasions, only to be bloodily suppressed at the hands of Prefectus Commissariats and the Adeptus Arbites. The halt in the Necron advance granted the Imperial forces almost 3 months to muster, and this was far from wasted. The armies arrayed at Amara had grown to formidable proportions. Over 19 million Astra Militarum guardsmen, with almost 10 times that number in militia, raised under emergency edict and armed and equipped along the Munitorum's Cadian pattern. One of the last contingents to arrive in system, and perhaps the most storied of all out-of-sector Militarum reinforcements, were 2 million soldiery of the Death Corps of Krieg, led by the veteran 17th Line Corps under the command of Marshal Karis Venner. It was, however, not only the Militarum that answered Orpheus's plea for aid. The call to arms had been heeded by several chapters of the Adeptus Astartes, most notably what appeared to be the entirety of the Minotaur's chapter, entering the northern reaches of the sector with brutal haste alongside a company from the Marauder's chapter. Elements from the Red Seraphs and the Nemesis chapter had likewise delivered astropathic missives to Amara, notifying it of their imminent arrival. The battle barges of these chapters, now numbering in 4, added their might to the armada orbiting the capital, several hundred escort-class vessels and more than 60 rated cruisers and capital ships of the Imperial Navy. It was a staggering force of arms arrayed for the defense of a single world, even a sector capital, at least by modern Imperial standards, especially when even the barest hint of the enemy's nature still remained wholly unknown. Belligerent calls for more immediate action became more common as the weeks proceeded, but La'an and his advisors remained resolute in their strategy of patient, unyielding defense. The idea of a counterattack into the lost regions of Orphean space was simply not countenanced. But likewise, La'an forbid even the conducting of reconnaissance in force to establish even the most remote facts about enemy movements, strength, or nature. For all the world, it appeared the governor and his council simply dared not disturb the dark veil that had been thrown over the lost worlds of Orpheus. In a report laterally compiled by Inquisitor Scarman Havas of the Ordo Xenos following the fall of Orpheus, Inquisitor Hiram Nithsona, high-ranking survivor of the sector's inquisitorial conclave and a close advisor to the governor following the beginning of the Bloody Hundred, was ruled, post-mortem, to have had his conduct in this period found wanting. Nithsona had been an esteemed and rightly lauded demon hunter of the Ordo Malleus for some 2 centuries, and his record was genuinely unimpeachable. The unavoidable conclusion of Inquisitor Havas, however, was that in this final trial of the Emperor's service, the venerable Nithsona had allowed his own fears and paranoia to become his undoing. From the beginning, as one has noted in this record thus far, Nithsona was adamant that the Calamitous invasion was a ploy mean the schemes of the dark gods of primordial annihilation, whose abilities to invoke malefic stellar phenomenon on a large scale is undeniably based in fact. Nichona viewed the progress of events as merely a preamble to a greater threat to come, even as the situation worsened and no extant proof of demonic incursions provided itself in the least. Owing to this, it was laterally concluded by the Inquisition that vital intelligence was not given full scrutiny, or indeed was passed on by Nichona to the servants of the Ordo Xenos, where Inquisitor Havas noted, with no small amount of prideful surety, actual value may have been gleaned. Havas's report points to Inquisitor Nichona's close association with Governor La'an, and his inability to properly deal with the governor's clearly degrading mental functionality as proof of his lapse of judgment. To quote the report, following the beginning of what the Imperium now knows to be the Necron assault on the sector, La'an became plagued with a series of increasingly vivid nightmares, in which he found himself seated at a great feasting table, surrounded by terrifying deathly figures La'an himself describes as being, quote, masked in bone and gilded steel, clad in the golden and darkly jeweled raiment of barbarous alien kings and princes. Set before them were platters and dishes, on which lay, alternately, grey dust, glowing cinders, and raw, bloody meat. At the head of the table is a vast enthroned figure, quote, more terrible than the rest, so fearful I knew my heart would fail if I looked directly upon them. In this dread company, La'an found himself trapped and bidden to eat the strange meal while the deathly court looked on, all watching him in malignant silence, save one, draped in raw skins that ravened at the unholy banquet, smearing bloody chunks of flesh onto its twisted mask, even though it could not eat, drenching itself with flagons of steaming blood, even though it could not drink. When, in the dream, La'an could not stand any more of this horror and cried to be let go, a hooded and shrouded figure appeared at his back and whispered to him, quote, these are the worlds that were once ours, the worlds that you trespassed upon and are now ours again. The worlds on which we have risen have already been cleansed. The worlds where we once walked, we shall now walk again. As the rites demand, you are given a cycle of the pale stars to prepare yourself for extermination. Maenarch comes, and the banquet shall be served again. Inquisitor Nichona, being of demon hunter stock, clearly interpreted these recurrent dreams as the work of the warp, demonic emanations of the vilest sort insinuating themselves into La'an's sleeping mind, tormenting the governor with treacherous prophecy designed only to deceive La'an into surrendering intelligence on troop movements to their foul masters in the material world. Ironically, in hindsight, based on significant Ordo Xenos encounters with and study of the rising threat of the Necron dynasties in the era Indomitus, it is quite likely that everything within these dreams was the stark, literal truth. In cross-referencing La'an's case with those reported elsewhere by Inquisitors Boas, Straker, and Valyria, it is likely that La'an, despite being an Imperial commander and surrounded by the protections such as the office brings, was abducted covertly, with the Maenarch nobility deigning to treat him as the head of the forces opposing the Necrons in the region. In this, the dynasty was extending to him the ancient courtesies and honors their culture had demanded of foes prior to the Great Sleep, even as a member of the species the Necrons themselves consider utterly beneath them in every capacity. The experience was so clearly so unearthly, traumatic, and malign that it irrevocably damaged the mind of Governor La'an, in such a fashion that caused his surface consciousness to block it out. It remains a terrible irony that, once again, the signs of what was to come were very readily available, drawn in a string of crumbs across history, and rising to greater prominence, yet the Imperium's dogmatic and hidebound nature rendered it wholly unable to see them. On 3-970-992-M41, the Battle of Amara began as suddenly as the initial Mainark invasion had, without preamble, preface, or prelude. No astropathic shockwave announced the Necron attack, no deep system auger sweeps detected them. At 153-4202 local timescale, a massive gravitational flux sprang into being near the Amara star, its shockwaves causing the sun to violently eject plasma and radiation into space in a series of massive solar flares. Such was the fury of these flares that the system's innermost planet, Auric, was flash incinerated on its day side in a single instant. Vox, Sensorium, and Augur networks across the system failed immediately, drowned in a cascade of stellar radiation, rendering much of the Imperial defenses blind and deaf. Many unshielded technologies, not hardened against EMAG shocks, were likewise disabled. The confusion and chaos was so total that it wasn't until the Sentinel-4 battle station in deep orbit suddenly detonated that the cause became monstrously clear. The enemy had finally come for the Imperium. At Leighton, third planet in the system, the Imperial battle fleet had been arrayed for months in a solid defensive picket, blockading what was, by any conventional wisdom, the surest route to the capital planet from the system's Mandeville point of warp translation. Such wisdom, of course, did not apply against the Necrons. As backup auguries and visual suites came online, the commanders of the fleet saw with horror that an armada of black ships hung in the near space of the dead battle station, accelerating still at speeds barely registrable. Calculus Logi stated they would be in Amara's orbit in mere minutes. The battle fleet had been utterly bypassed. To use a simplistic analogy, the enemy was within the walls. The orbital minefields and weapons batteries of Amara's near space were the next target. The invading fleet swept through them with a clinical precision, carefully constructed defenses of decades impeding them not one bit. The remaining Sentinel battle stations, each with the proportional firepower of an entire cruiser squadron, were systematically obliterated, all while the Imperial battle fleet was still firing up their engines, beating to quarters, and desperately trying to plot the fastest intercept course available. There was simply no time to interdict. Planetfall was happening with the inevitability of a bullet already fired. Unnatural storms boiled across the capital world skies, sliced through by cracks of vivid lightning. It seemed that, for all the world, the enemy rode in upon the lightning. First contact between invaders and defenders is believed to have occurred in the wide ceremonial plazas of Kaloshin Hive, where a veritable army of humanoid forms in black iron materialized in advance with no pause of fanfare, committing themselves immediately to the base slaughter of the terrified populace that fled before them. At Durinad Starport, swarms of insectoid constructs emerged from subterranean access tunnels, tearing apart the shuttles and gunships on the runways around them like a plague of ancient Catheric mythic tracts. New Vassburg, one of the planet's largest hives, was targeted by crescent-shaped enemy flyers, identified laterally as Doomscythe and Night Shroud-class aircraft by the Ordo Xenos. The latter, in particular, launched pinpoint barrages of antimatter bombs, shredding structural supports until the hive simply imploded in a collapse that killed countless millions. While the cities were clearly the primary targets of the Necron attack, they soon began to target military installations. Foremost amongst them, the Bastion Militaris, located at the planet's northern pole. Against this, the Necron set fearsome siege constructs, hovering soundlessly above the ice floes, but unleashing apocalyptic barrages from their energy weapons and seismic obliterators, shredding and cracking the walls of the Imperial Fortress. Elsewhere, The barrack blocks of Markovan Peninsula, built to house nearly a million guardsmen, were simply annihilated from orbit, leaving nothing but ash and fused silicate glass where once an entire army had been billeted. Despite these already punishing losses, and the ability of the enemy to simply appear within their midst, the Imperial defenders mounted what counterattacks they could muster. At Kaloshin Hive, the tanks of the Tekarn 234th Armored Battalion learned the hard way that they were quite susceptible to even the small arms fire of the Necrons, whose Gauss flares could strip the plating of a tank with ease. An open battle was death, forcing the Tekarn commanders to concentrate their forces on open plazas and thoroughfares to grant them the advantage of long range wherever possible. Engaged by rank after rank of Necron warriors, the numbers of the invaders seemed barely to be dented, and those yet damaged by Imperial shellfire began before the eyes of the defenders to reassemble their mechanical bodies. The Tekarn did not relent in their barrage, and kept firing until their cannon barrels began to glow dull red with heat. A stalemate of sorts had been struck, but one the Tekarn officers knew they could not sustain, and indeed, did not. Death struck them from below and above simultaneously, according to survivor testimony. The Necrons deployed their Akenthrite canoptic constructs, believed to be some of the first Imperial forces to encounter such blasphemous automatons. Unlike the canoptic wraiths who bear a similar form, Akenthrites are capable of atmospheric flight, and their thermal beams function akin to Imperial meltas. Plunging from the skies upon the column, the constructs reaped a fearsome toll of Imperial war machines. Slaughter only added to by a pincer attack from below, as Canoptic tomb sentinels, horrific burrowing anthropod-like machines, burst forth, massacring what remained. Within days, Amara Prime was in ruins. Every single main hive had fallen to the Mainarch dynasty. No quarter or mercy was offered. No demands had been made. No reprieve was granted in the implacable Xenocide. Yet loci of Imperial defenses remained intact and functioning. The Death Corps of Krieg under Marshal Venner had been deployed in Karsala Industrial District, far from the main hive conurbations. Upon the outbreak of hostilities, they immediately set about fortifying their position with trench emplacements, connecting command stations, dugouts, and ammunition dumps with the region's pre-existing utility tunnel network. Such foresight allowed them to weather the first wave of attacks relatively unscathed, the enemy seeming to avoid their fortifications in favor of weaker Imperial targets and civilian population centers. When the Krieg counterattack was launched, it came in force, and was aimed specifically at incorporating surviving Imperial forces into itself. Marshal Venner personally executed many senior commanders of surviving bands for dereliction of duty, permitting the surviving guardsmen opportunities as martyr redemptors upon the Line Corps front lines. The Marshal's forces swelled to over 200,000 Astra Militarum within days, as well as nearly a dozen cobbled-together squadrons of Aeronautica Imperialis aircraft. The Death Corps' renowned skills in operating in annihilated environments, such as the ruins of Amara, was highly valuable at this stage of the campaign. The Corps shifted their tactics based upon several first engagements with the Necrons, applying overwhelming artillery fire to deny the Necrons long-ranged fire at every opportunity. The relentless advance of Necron warriors was stalled by similarly implacable Krieg guardsmen, fanatical in their devotion to the Imperial cause, making great success in comparison to other Militarum forces, but at a horrific toll in lives. Marshal Venner was of course aware of the dire nature of his situation. What victories he was winning were temporary at best, and the enemy were seemingly in total control of the planet already. In perhaps archetypal Krieg mentality, he settled upon glorious martyrdom in the Emperor's name as the only route worthy of consideration. But he would not do so without a target. This he was provided thanks to reconnaissance undertaken by the Minotaur's chapter, who had established that within the ruins of New Vassburg, a step pyramid of green-black stone, the angles of which hurt the eyes of all those who beheld it, had risen from the rubble, appearing to pull bolt after bolt of lightning from the boiling skies above onto its apex. Several other lesser citadels, made of that same malignant stonework, rose around it, connected to each other by a web of angular, alien trenchwork. Necron forces, in great number, patrolled this complex, and could be observed dragging human corpses into the great, hungering maw of the pyramid. Venner's attack on the Necron Citadel was horrendously bloody. The sentry pylons of the fortress reaped hundreds of advancing Krieg and other guardsmen within minutes, and the opening Imperial artillery bombardment was deflected by advanced energy shields of the pyramids. Committing everything to the attack, Marshal Venner was met with similar commitment by the Necrons, who unleashed a horde of warriors and Canoptech constructs in the defense of their emplacements. As probing attacks against Imperial artillery began to deprecate their effectiveness, the Krieg nevertheless managed a breakthrough upon the battlefield, reaching the outlying alien citadels at the cost of thousands of their own, surrounding Necrons and bracketing them within murderous crossfire. Krieg engineers, experts in breaching fortified structures, were hurriedly deployed, cracking open each citadel in turn and rushing within. Despite the utterly unknown workings of the Xenos technology they beheld, they were, nevertheless, Krieg with explosives, and judiciously applied the Emperor's destruction to whatever power conduits or energy outputs they could determine would be effective. One by one, the Necron pyramids were destroyed, often at the cost of the soldiers that brought them down. As the death toll on Amara climbed into the billions, the Necron fleet turned its attention to the Imperial ships within the system. If Imperial commanders had believed the relatively tiny amount of Xenos ships would flee before such a vast human armada, they were sorely mistaken. With an ease that one senior officer described as almost contemptuous, the Necron ships smoothly came about and arrayed themselves against the incoming Orphean fleet, and began to accelerate to speeds that almost defied sensor readings. The Maenarch fleet held, by Imperial readings, less than a quarter of their number, and by logistic standards, far less tonnage, with their ships being thin or small in comparison to Imperial Navy behemoths. The exception to these were two mighty tomb ships, 15 kilometers in span, with sinister pyramids crusting their surfaces. These were codified by Imperial strategos as the Sun Killer and Dead Hand for identification purposes, and marked as targets of extreme priority given their size. Having now identified the invaders as Necrons, the senior Navy officers noted that the concentration of power before them, however small in comparison to their own Navy, still represented one of, if not the, largest deployment of Necron starships on Imperial record. Previous encounters were extremely rare, but had gone very poorly for the Navy, and the Mechanicus Magi aboard were frantically hailing bridge officers regarding unknowable energy readings concentrated around the largest enemy ships. On the bridge of the Apocalypse-class battleship Arica Dominus, Grand Admiral George Carew, Knight Commander of Battlefleet Orpheus, conferred with the helmeted form of Asterion Moloch, Chapter Master of the Minotaurs, via Hololith. Moloch, himself aboard the relic battle barge Daedalus Creta, and commanding a dozen Astartes strike cruisers besides, declared that he would take a secondary echelon behind the Imperial forward battle volume, preparing to strike at a potential weak point in the Necron vanguard, or to deal with any ships that attempted a breakthrough. This was not a move poised for discussion. Moloch simply did as he saw fit, deigning to inform Admiral Carew out of basic politeness. The Admiral acceded, ordering his fleet to advance and engage only as ordered, under pain of death. Not that the Imperials would have any much opportunity to slip their leashes. as the Necron ships entered extreme weapons range even before the line of battle had been fully formed. Ranging fire was immediately ordered, through which the Necron ships passed completely undeterred. Even as a swarm of torpedoes was launched, the Xenos made no move to correct their course or take evasive maneuvers. Now entering terminal range, scores of the torpedoes simply ceased to function. They sped off in entirely new directions or exploded harmlessly on the hulls of the Necron vessels. Hoving now into lance range, the invaders finally discharged their weaponry to ruinous effect. Massive gravitational distortions were registered as Imperial ships detected incoming weapons fire approaching at nearly the speed of light. After-action reports logged by the pitiful few survivors that made it out of this conflagration later claimed that what sensor readings could track the projectiles labeled them as fragments of dead stars. The battlecruiser Rychtenbach, a vessel whose service record dated from the beginnings of the Great Crusade, was hit amidships and simply detonated. It was merely the first. Admiral Carew ordered the entire battle fleet to come about and effect broadside fire at will, clearly seeing the futility in attempting the usual careful, coordinated dance of ships that typically defined void warfare. The Necron ships sliced through the Imperial fleet amidst a hail of lance fire and macro cannon shells, discharging their own fearsome batteries in return. Both armadas raked each other without pause or mercy, but as they parted, fully a quarter of the Imperial ships present had been destroyed or crippled beyond rescue, with barely any damage having been registered upon the Necrons. The Xenos, having passed to the rear of the Imperial fleet, were expected to begin a slow arc back, hopefully granting Carew some time to ready up another storm in response. But to the horror of all observers, the alien ship simply stopped. Their momentum was utterly, impossibly arrested. And then, they simply turned. With impossible ease, the ships came about and began returning on the path they had come, straight into the exposed rear of the Imperial fleet. The second attack, perhaps predictably, was supremely more devastating than the first. Blinded by their own drive flares, the Imperial ships could barely detect the positioning of the alien vessels as they came within killing range. They were the easiest of prey. Admiral Carew bellowed disengage orders into his Vox, but it was still too late. The Retribution-class battleship Talisman of Grace was caught before the Sun Killer and sheared in half by its Gauss arrays, while the heavy cruiser Mendicatus was pulled apart mercilessly by a pack of Necron raiders, alongside dozens more craft burning and breaking in the silent void. What line of battle had remained was quickly sundered, with Imperial starships plunging in whatever direction they could, lashing out at any targets of opportunity. The Arcia Dominus, against the odds, claimed the life of a Necron harvest ship, only to be targeted in return by a trio of Necron raiders who guttered its starboard batteries and set fire to her main engineerium. Out of control, the flagship tumbled away into the void, the horrified senior command watching on flickering holospheres as the Xenos ships danced amongst the dead and soon to die like carrion beasts reveling in slaughter. Asterion Moloch of the Minotaurs, having observed the debacle, knew even his Astartes ships would likely be wholly outclassed by the firepower, durability, and maneuverability of the Xenos. The Dower Chapter Master instead ordered an immediate attack upon a single target, the tomb ship labeled Dead Hand. Adopting an attack formation in the shape of a bull's head, with the Daedalus Crater forming the protected skull, and the Chapter's three battle barges the jaws, its eight strike cruisers the horns, the Minotaur's fleet smashed into the heart of battle, engines at full burn. The strike cost them the Daughter of Tempests, a battle barge taken as a prize in the Badab War, alongside the Fidelitas Lambda and a trio of strike cruisers. It did, however, bring the Minotaurs into the boarding range they sought. The boarding torpedoes that delivered the chapter into the heart of the Dead Hand brought the brazen Astartes into a charnel house of a wholly alien sort, one whose constructs and warriors reacted to the invading marines as a body reacts to a virus. Losses were extreme. Within a half hour, only Terminator Squad Ixthalion survived, having fought its way into the heart of the ship's central chamber. Within that massive area, a kilometer wide, arose a great dais upon which stood the overlord of the fleet, clad in a cloak of raw darkness. It would be the last sight the warriors of Squad Ixthalion would see as Lichguard stepped from within the seemingly living darkness to butcher these human transgressors. They survived long enough to send a signal to the Daedalus Krayta, one the battle barge used to target the chamber and fire every weapon battery they could upon the location. Curiously for Necron vessels, the Mainark tomb ship was recorded as having an atmosphere, likely an aspect of the flare curse that befell the dynasty, for no Necron had any reason or need to breathe. The fact was exploited by the Minotaurs. The central chamber was breached by the targeted bombardment, with explosive decompression bucking the tomb ship off course. One great arm of its crescent sweep caught the Daedalus Krayta in a glancing blow, sending the relic battle barge spinning in space, where, aboard, Asterion Moloch, alongside his chapters in Terminator Elite and several Hecaton Contemptor Dreadnoughts, crashed through the veil of reality in an audacious teleport assault. Against the sinister fleet lord did Moloch range himself, in a clash of silent, wordless fury. Their singular combat, an honor perhaps deigned by the Necron Lord, was not abided by Moloch, who sought only to kill. The Hecaton dreadnoughts of the chapter aided their master, but such was the skill of the Xenos Overlord that ruin was brought upon their ancient chassis. But triumph Moloch did, impaling the sinister figure upon the black spear of the Minotaurs, before a catastrophic impact dislodged the two combatants and swept Moloch and the surviving Astartes back out into the void. The Dead Hand tomb ship turned slowly, pivoting away from the burning hulk of the battle barge Fidelitas Lambda. The Minotaur's ship had rammed the Xenos vessel at full speed, but this dying act had forced the tomb ship to effect a retreat. With their flagship on the move, the Xenos fleet likewise disengaged, driven off at best, not defeated, leaving within their wake utter devastation. The Sunkiller and a dozen escorting raiders unexpectedly split from the body of the fleet and made landing on the night side of Oryk, whose face was soon consumed by dark storms and pulses of unnatural radiance. The remainder and the wounded Dead Hand simply vanished, without a trace whatsoever. It is possible that they effected an acceleration so fast that Imperial augurs were unable to track them, or perhaps some altogether more unknowable technological means covered their retreat. Either way, they were gone, but the victory could hardly have been any more pyrrhic. Less than 10% of the Imperial ships remained operational, and even these survivors bore deep, painful scars. Amara Prime, although now liberated from its primary invasion force, was a graveyard of billions. Whatever recompense the Imperium had claimed there had been bought at the most terrible price. The surviving forces were evacuated as quickly as possible from the ruins, pulled back to the outer worlds of Lamon and Kalama to regroup. Of the remnants of the civilian population, those unlucky enough to remain alive in the dark, charnel destruction, the Imperium abandoned them to whatever fate awaited. The Battle of Amara was over. By the dawning of 995 M41, the Orphean War, such as it remained, had reached a bloody, punitive stalemate. But scattered forces did not retreat from the destruction of Amara, or Hydrogast, were wholly cut off from the Imperium, left to wither or sell their lives. Attrition rates along the front line reached some 60%, with no Imperial gains or advances being made. The line held, but at a staggering cost. Worse still, fresh conflicts broke out in the Chimarium system as planets fell to the hands of the arch-enemy who had launched opportunistic invasions, with the Imperium reeling from the Necron assault. At Myer and Amraphel, Xenos probing attacks were increasing, with Imperial strategos rating the possibility of a full invasion occurring as quite high. This, combined with the difficulty of immediate resupply and the utter devastation of Battlefleet Orpheus during the initial invasion, led the Synod Militaris of Segmentum Tempestus to conclude that the Orpheus sector could not be saved without the deployment of a Crusade-level military force, which, by Munitorum calculations, accounting for the already in-progress Segmentum conflicts and the vagaries of future ones occurring, would not be at the Imperium's disposal for approximately 3 to 5 decades. This report worked its way through the upper layers of the Munitorum and Administratum before being delivered to the eyes of the High Lords of Terra for a conclusive vote. It is apparent from historical records of Senatorum proceedings that the Ordo Xenos had a very heavy hand in the progress of this report. The emergence of the Maenarch dynasty in such force had, at the time, been one of the largest and most aggressive awakenings of the Necrons yet encountered by the Imperium, and the scale of the devastation it had unleashed had forced major synods of the Ordo to urgently re-examine their writings, protocols, and policies concerning Imperial engagement with the species. In consultation with the Death Watch chapter of the Adeptus Astartes, the Ordo Xenos was in the process of launching exploratory and research expeditions into what remained of the Orpheus sector, and clearly wanted to ensure little could impede their efforts. The Chamber Mori, in recommendation to the Senate, and championed by Inquisitorial Representative Cleopatra Arx, advanced and passed the Orphean Decree, an Edict Imperialis that formally discorporated the sector. As of 0266999 M41, Orpheus was no more. It did not exist. Its tithes were annulled, its authority stripped, its history sealed, and committed to the deepest vaults, to be unremembered. A cordon of fortress worlds, primarily based in the neighboring Eurydice sector, were ordered constructed, and a military cordon enforced, to deny the Necrons any resources they could claim from planets still controlled by the Imperium. The Minotaurs were ordered to commit exterminatus, pending their refitting and rearmament following their losses. Thus did Orpheus fall, in cold fire. Thus did a region of Imperial space collapse, millennia of history snuffed out in scarcely a year by a foe who had dwelled beneath its surface all along. Its fate remains as we leave it, a blackened husk of space, a testament to the blinkered ignorance of the Imperium, a loss of staggering scale, and one rendered into relative obscurity only for the immense losses and calamities the Imperium was to endure in the waning months of 999 M41. The fall of Cadia, the Noctis Aeterna, the opening of the Cicatrix Maledictum. Even for the Maenarch dynasty, their current disposition and fate remains unclear to Imperial scholarship. The return of the Silent King and the unfolding of the Pariah Nexus has cast new fears that the bloody-handed warriors of Zun Bakir may throw themselves anew at the Imperial cordon that has yet to keep them in check, effecting a breakout from their dynastic heartlands in an effort to rejoin the lord of their species. This remains to be seen. As for the Minotaurs, one cannot independently confirm if their proposed exterminatus campaign was ever carried out. Their presence upon Terra during the Hexarchy crisis casts doubt upon this, but given the extreme chronological disruption to the galaxy following the Noctis Aeterna, and the curious nature of the chapter themselves, we will likely never know. For now, the Orphean War has been as totally buried as the population that once dwelt there. A shameful chapter of history that the Imperium would rather forget. Ave Imperator. Gloria in excelsis Terra. This video and this channel were made possible thanks to the very kind donations and support from my Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to help support the channel, head on over to patreon.com/oculusimperia. If you'd like to receive more updates about the channel and any future videos, you can contact me or follow me on Twitter @OculusImperia. Otherwise, please like, subscribe, comment, let me know your feedback, and as ever, thank you very much for watching.